Podcast.
The thrill of a Packers game at Lambeau Field? If so, be sure to get your game ticket from the longtime trusted source in Wisconsin, Ticket King. Visit their locations in Milwaukee and Green Bay, or just go to their website at ticketking.com. Again, that's theticketking.com.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Pulse of the Pack. It is finally time to talk about some football, actual things going on the field instead of speculation and thoughts and all kinds of other stuff. Now, finally, on-field play has begun. The Packers are 1 week into training camp. As we record this right now, family night is tomorrow night. The Packers have had two padded practices, which is real football. Helmets and shorts don't do much for me, at least. I am Jacob Westendorf, your host, and joined with me, as always, is Jason Perrone. Jason, how's it hanging?
Everything is going well. Nice little Saturday, to quote a line from Old School, the movie, over here in the Twin Cities area. So it's going well, and yeah, Jacob, I mean, practice isn't anything what it used to be when they were doing two-a-days a while back, and there was tons of updates and things you could glean from guys in pads, which I think the Packers didn't even put the pads on until the third day this week. But nonetheless, you're right. Football's back. It's exciting. Could be more thrilled to actually be talking about some substance, and some substance do we have today. That is awesome. Packers football is back. Very excited.
That's true. Packers football is back. And with us also is, to my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, the newest addition to the Cheesehead TV team. We have Zach Jacobson with us. Zach, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Loud and clear, perfect. Zach, tell us a little bit about yourself in the introduction. Who are you? How long have you been with us? Where can we find your stuff? Things like that.
First, I just want to say thank you guys for having me on the show. I am a longtime Packer fan. I used to cover them for the NFC North Barroom before I had the privilege of joining Cheesehead TV by the end of May. Very, very lucky to be part of that team. You can find me on Twitter at Zach A. Jacobson. And you can find me at Cheesehead TV.
So there you have it. That is Zach Jacobson. Zach, I got to say, one of my favorite things since I started following you on Twitter is a lot of people try and play their professionalism card, which is fine, and I'm not saying you're unprofessional by any stretch of the imagination, but watching you trade barbs with Vikings and Bears fans is one of my favorite things to see, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm glad I can bring you happiness with that.
As a Packers fan who grew up in Bears country, and Jason's obviously in Vikings country, we're surrounded by plenty of drivel from those people. Just had an argument with somebody the other day as to why the Bears won't win 11 games this season, because they were adamant that's what was going to happen. But before we get into our show here, Jason, you have an update on one of our good friends, Adam Cech. How's he doing?
Okay, so Adam, as you guys know, has been battling the colon cancer. We know this, and it's been going on for a while. This past week was a huge step for him in his recovery. He actually went out to New York with his wife. It's the second time they've been out to New York to see a specialist and a team that was going to give a second crack to a surgery that they tried to perform on him back in January and had to stop because of how far the cancer had spread at that point. He's in stage four at this point, which, as we know, is pretty advanced. But colon cancer, you know, odds are a little bit better in that type of a scenario, and Adam's also got age on his side. He's a pretty young guy. So got out there, and the doctors were willing to proceed with the procedure. The long and short of it is, and some of you may already know this through the updates that you might be getting from his wife, spent 13 hours in surgery yesterday. That's not a typo, folks. He spent 13 hours under the knife in New York City yesterday with one of the best teams that deal with this type of surgery, and he had a couple different surgeons working on him. He did complete the surgery. It's never one of those things where you come out of surgery and everything is just A-okay automatically. So I want to caution, you know, against giving that type of a a prognosis, but his wife did say that the surgery itself, they were able to remove quite a bit of the cancer. He was able to get some additional chemo treatment afterwards, which was the second part of the plan. As far as I know, they're back at their spot of lodging back east, resting right now, and until Adam is well enough to come back. The hope is that they're going to be able to take a scan, and he's going to be considered disease-free. I mean, to say cancer-free is a little premature, but Guy, you all know, you know, if you know Adam and you follow his Surviving Sundays piece and you follow him on Twitter, you know he's a huge WWE fan. I mean, this guy really truly is an ultimate warrior. He's absolutely an incredible human being. He is an incredible guy. I've met him on a couple of occasions. Jacob, you and I saw him at the Patriots game in 2014, which also happened to fall on his birthday. And, you know, the best part was when Julie gave the updates. You know, obviously Adam, you know, he had to have, you know, some of his colon taken out, and some other things removed too, but the one thing that kind of made everyone smile in the update was that she made sure that he was going to continue to be able to drink beer, which was one of the most important pieces for Adam, and if you know Adam at all. So, Adam, my brother, we love you over here. So excited to hear the news. I definitely not a dry eye in the house morning when I was kind of reading that update, and couldn't be more excited to hear that the surgery at least was completed. So, you know, not out of the woods yet, but definitely a step in the right direction. So definitely raise your glasses and cheers to Adam Scheck and his continued recovery.
Absolutely agree. And if you're a WWE guy, I'll say it. Since we're in an interesting stage here, throw a Stone Cold Stunner on this thing. We believe in you. And like I said, I've said before several times, this is your battle to win. And we also have an open invitation for you to be on this show if you ever feel up to it. We'd love to have you as a guest sometime. Zach, my understanding is also you'd like to say a few things, so the floor is yours.
I just recently had the privilege of knowing Adam and, you know, getting to learn about him and his whole fight with cancer, and I really just want to say, you know, he's putting up an incredible fight, and I can't wait till he's you know, back on the scene again, talking Packers football and WWE, doing everything he loves. And hats off to those doctors, too, for, you know, just helping him the whole way through and performing the successful surgery.
Absolutely agree. So that is our update on Adam Scheck. Here begins our update of Packers football, and there's really no good way to segue from that to football, so that's the best I can do. Forgive me if that is not good enough. As I stated, the Packers have had four practices now as we stand here, two without pads, two with them. And the first thing I want to start with is the battle that everybody's been watching really since the end of the season, wide receivers. Mike McCarthy said today in his pre-practice press conference that you'd like to have six, maybe five, and that the players would decide that. So with that in mind, that kind of kills speculation, at least for now, about the Packers keeping seven wide receivers, and that means a pretty good player that can play a role is going to be released, whether that's Jared Aberderis, Trevor Davis, Jeff Janis, Ty Montgomery, probably not him, but Davante Adams, among others. To make here early on, there's a tweet I quoted earlier, and it got quite a bit of discussion. It said from Aaron Nagler, the godfather of Cheesehead TV, that someone told him within Lambeau that Jared Aberderis has been the Packers' best receiver in camp. Now, when we started talking about this, we kind of said that Aberderis was looking like he was on the outside looking in. And that still, as I think about it, appears to be the case, but that is some pretty interesting information, along with the information that Trevor Davis has gotten off to a pretty good start as well. He was the clear star of the first day of camp. Now, that was in shorts, but he hasn't exactly lost a ton of momentum since the first couple days of camp. He's made some plays here with the pads on as well. So those are two guys that are toward, theoretically at least, the bottom of the depth chart as far as receivers go. Jason, we'll start with you here. What do you make of the whole receiver rumblings as we start here?
Well, so I'll kind of revert back to what I've been saying the last couple times we talked about this, and unfortunately it's the Packers, so we can't ignore the elephant in the room, which always tends to be health. And I don't think we're going to have to – I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where seven receivers is going to ever grow any legs. I think we're past that point now. And there's no health issues as far as I know on the receiver side of things, except for Jordy Nelson's continued recovery from his ACL injury and then his little hiccup earlier this week that was reported, but you know, and if, depending on who you ask, his leg's either falling off or it's completely fine. But I think that you've got Ty Montgomery, and I've said this and I wrote about it too a while ago. I mean, probably over a month ago, that I think Ty Montgomery is the linchpin to this whole conversation because he's the one that seems to have trouble recovering. I shouldn't say trouble because I don't know if he's actually struggling or behind in his recovery from the ankle injury, but he's definitely slowly coming along. I mean, I know that he's been out there. I don't think he's been really participating as much because that ankle's just given him a hard time. And I've listened to a lot of the beat writers who have covered the team talking about this injury. They don't seem too overly encouraged right now. And the other thing we have to remember too, and I think Jacob, you and I've talked about this probably the last, you know, however long we've been doing shows together, the Packers do some creative things with injuries with training camp, and they do this in order to protect the player from getting hurt further. So I think there's medical diligence that's going on there from the doctors, and they're very conservative. So we know the medical team is very conservative, but they also try to protect players in creative ways, you know, and I'll phrase it like that because there are rules and such that the team has to abide by. But I think it's very feasible that, if unless we see some sort of miraculous improvement from Ty Montgomery and he's out there catching balls, I have not heard a single thing about him running routes, catching balls. Jordy Nelson has not run a single route at all either. I think Montgomery is probably headed towards either starting the season on the PUP list, physically unable to perform list, which once we get into the regular season means I think it's a minimum of 6 weeks that they're going to miss and they can't practice for a certain amount of time, and they can't come back before that six-week mark. Now, in training camp, being on PUP, some fans have gotten nervous about that. Jacob, you and I have kind of calmed a couple of fears this week. It's different. You can be activated off of PUP and training camp and be back on the field either later that same day or the following day, so it's not a huge deal. The health is going to decide this battle. Now, to hear Abby's the number one receiver in camp, I had not heard that before. That's actually very surprising, but it's also not. Jordy's not out there. Ty's not out there. So those two guys are not out there. Janice is still running the wrong routes. I heard it again today. He dropped a touchdown pass, or he actually didn't drop a touchdown pass. He ran a bad route. Still doesn't know to come back to the ball. He doesn't seem to understand how to use his strengths to his advantage. Yes, I understand what he did against Arizona and the lynch mob that formed after that for free Janice, save Janice, whatever hashtag you want to throw out there. But Aberderis has just always done what he's supposed to do. He runs crisp routes. He actually came out and caught a fade for a touchdown after that Janice mishap there, which had Aaron Rodgers frustrated in practice. So not too surprising. I mean, Devontae Adams is coming along, but he has such a long road to go because of the fact that everybody kind of was down on him last year. I feel like he could be lighting it up for days and days, but everybody's still going to put that asterisk next to it and say, yeah, but remember 2015. So good for Aberderis. I think he's probably, you know, a lock to stick on this team if he stays healthy. He's just got too much support if you listen to what everybody's saying. So it's going to come down to health. And I think, like I said, I think Ty Montgomery is that linchpin.
Hopefully that is not the case because that would mean somebody got injured and that could be anyone. But Jason, as you said, health seems to determine these battles more often than not. The last guy is the one I want to talk about. Zach, we haven't gotten your opinion on this before. Jeff Janis. With John Kuhn gone, is clearly the new folk hero. Even with Kuhn on the team last year, it was clear that Janice has a large amount of support from the fan base. So my question is, where do you stand on this? Is he Janice Christ, or is he just a mere mortal that's really big and fast and can't run routes?
Well, as a wide receiver, his best friend really is running routes. And if you can't run routes, you're not going to be effective on the field. I don't care how quick you are. You can be a deep threat, but if your quarterback can't find you where you're supposed to be, especially with a quarterback like Aaron Rodgers, who a lot of his connections with his receivers are really based on timing, you know, back shoulder throws, being exactly where you are when you're supposed to be. And with Jeff Janis, you know, as much as they work on it in camp, I'm not sure where I see the production value with him on offense, but he has proven to be, you know, a gunner on special teams, a kick returner. He has worth on special teams, and that I think is where the edge kind of separates him between himself and Jared Aberderis, because Jared Aberderis also has the ACL tear in his resume, the rib injury last year he suffered, and you know, he does have the crisp route running skills, but I'm not really sure where that fits in. I think Trevor Davis offers a lot more to the roster, and that just might be enough to give him the edge over Aberderis. It's really a revolving door right now with the wide receivers. But Jeff Janis, very, very overhyped on all across social media platforms, all across Packer Nation, as you guys mentioned. So you know, it'll be interesting to see whether he and Aaron Rodgers can somehow form a connection in camp and you know whether they can capitalize on that.
Absolutely a thing to watch. You know, there's been, it seems like anytime Rodgers blinks in the direction of Jeff Janis, there's a story given out by one of the beat writers, and that's understandable because, you know, reality is when Janis has been on the field, something positive has happened, whether it's him catching a shovel pass on a drag route and running for 40 yards or, you know, to quote Cheeseburger Eddie from the newest version of The Longest Yard, some schoolyard fill in the blank against the Arizona Cardinals, leading to a big night for Janis. It's intriguing, but again, you know, Jason and I have said several times on this show that schoolyard, again, fill in the blank, isn't how you run offense. And in order for Janis to crack the field, he's going to have to do some things within the offense because it only makes sense. That's how offense is run. It's about structure. It's about timing. You know, gimmicks only last for so long. That's why you see the Wildcat had its time and now it's gone. The Tim Tebow offense had its time very briefly and now it's gone. You know, Jeff Janis just can't rely on run really fast and beat the guy behind him or in front of him or run really fast and turn around. You just can't rely on that for very long. So that is something he has to continue to get better. It is the first week of camp. There's certainly a lot of time for him to do things to find a role within the offense, like I've said before, though. And, Zach, you alluded to it as well. You know, this is a elite special teams player, and I think because of that, he's a lock to make the roster because I was thinking about it while I was driving back home today that if Ron Zook starts his special teams meeting and just starts ranking players, Jeff Janis is number one on that list if he's not a kicker. So maybe Mason Crosby's number one, but Janis is certainly number one on that list. He returns. He did well as a returner last year. They're having him do some things as a punt returner this year, which is something we'll talk about very soon. And then obviously his coverage as a kickoff and punt returner, punt team gunner was very valuable last season. So a lot to be seen yet at the receiver position. It'll be the most intriguing battle. This is what I'm looking forward to preseason games for because those guys are going to have plenty of opportunities, especially with Nelson on the pup. And speaking of the pup list, we mentioned that Jordy Nelson is on it. We've kind of mentioned maybe some concern, maybe not. Ultimately, the timetable for him is a week one return, and I think that, you know, there's not a ton of reason at this point to believe that he won't be back for week one. So with that in mind, there's other guys that are on the pup list. My question, and Zach, I will start with you, is aside from Nelson, who that is currently on the physically unable to perform list needs to get back on the field the fastest?
Immediately, T.J. Lang, first guy that pops into my mind. Otherwise, they'd have to plug Don Barkley in, who it is worth mentioning. He's played all five positions on the offensive line so far in camp, but you know, Lang's the other half of arguably the best guard duo in football, and keeping him healthy means Aaron Rodgers stays healthy, and that's really the key to the Packers' success. You can make an argument for Corey Linsley, but behind him you have J.C. Treader, who if they plug him into center and start snapping the ball to A-Rod, then that's really not much of a loss. Cause J.C. Treader, he's a very, very talented center for a backup.
Absolutely, and you know, my answer is actually different from that. I'm going away from the offensive line because my understanding is those two players are on that list for precautionary reasons, and ultimately once they're back on the field, they'll be back on the field. I still don't see a scenario where Don Barkley makes this roster. Maybe that's more hope than anything else, but my answer is Jared Cook, and I had a story air yesterday about why he needs to get back on the field. Jared Cook brought a lot of excitement when he was signed because he's a tight end. He runs fast. He's a big target running through the middle of the field, which Mike McCarthy's talked about a ton since last season ended. Cook is a player, though, that is new to the offense. You know, Jordy Nelson is on the pup. He's not new. And Aaron Rodgers basically said it would take, quote, a couple of days for him to get back in the swing of things with Rodgers. Ty Montgomery has had a full season to learn the offense as well, and he's he's a good player, but ultimately at the end of the day, he's probably at best a fourth receiver on the roster. Not a whole lot of urgency to get him back either, but Jared Cook is brand new. He's never played with Aaron Rodgers before. He needs to get used to catching passes, build that rapport, build that relationship with him. So my answer for this question is Jared Cook, because last season the Packers' tight end production was not good. Richard Rodgers is supposedly leaner, which he hopes means quicker. I think at this point he kind of is what he is, and I've said what he is before, and I don't think that's a bad thing, but he's not a big target that can run, operative word being run, through the middle of the field and make plays down the seam. Jared Cook can do that, but there's not going to be a whole lot of good there if he's in the wrong spot, because then you'll hear the same stories about Jared Cook that you're currently hearing and we've discussed about Jeff Janis. Jason, on the pup list, who's your guy?
This is amazing to me, Jacob, because this isn't even, like, planned, and we all pick different guys. So it would be – I would probably say Cook and Lang are definitely two that would be, like, two and three on my list, but I'm looking at Sam Barrington because he's expected, although he's not, you know, a huge part of this defense, I don't think anyone is expecting him to be – a monster out there, but he's a veteran where you've got a lot of younger guys like Jake Ryan and, you know, we've got Martinez that is a rookie at the inside linebacker spot and not somebody you want to just throw in there and have to count on right away. They're both mid-round picks. They're not, you know, necessarily the type of players you can expect to step in and make a huge impact. So I think if Barrington has a long-term issue, and remember his injury took place in week one of the season last year. So everyone talks about Jordy Nelson and that timeline and the year mark and how long it takes to heal. Well, Sam Barrington's actually up against it more because his injury happened later, like 2 or 3 weeks after. So he's kind of a question mark there. I think expectations for him to come in and stabilize that unit, they want to keep Clay Matthews outside. If Sam Barrington's injured and he's not ready, I can guarantee you you're going to see more Clay on the inside, which isn't, as I've said before, is not a bad thing unless – you're of the belief and the feeling that Matthews inside is hurting the Packers defense and it's not the most ideal scenario. So I know they want to try to move him back outside. I don't necessarily know if that's totally realistic. Barrington's going to be a big piece of that. He's got to get back. And, you know, you spend too much time away from the game. You know, it's different. Nelson's a wide receiver. He's a skill player. So, you know, he's, you know, I don't want to say they work out differently, but they have different regimens to get ready. You know, Sam Barrington getting in football shape and chasing down ball carriers and getting lateral back and forth. I mean, he's never been a really fast guy, whereas I think Nelson had more to kind of lean on and get back to than Barrington does. So I'm looking at Sam Barrington and saying, hey, that could actually creep up and end up being a bigger deal than a lot of people are talking about right now, because everybody is kind of talking about Nelson, obviously, like Zach said, TJ Lang, and listening to Lang's comments, I think it sounds like he's hopefully going to be able to at least play in a couple preseason games. I don't think he'll be back right away, but he's itching to get back out there. It's a contract year, and he wants to play well and make himself some money. And then, obviously, Jacob, to your point, Jared Cook, another good choice there, too, because of all the expectations placed on him. But Sam Barrington, kind of one of those, you know, blue-collar type guys that maybe isn't like a huge, you know, we're not talking about a Desmond Bishop type of guy here. But that inside linebacker spot definitely needs some of that veteranship there. And if Barrington's out, I think that's going to be a pretty big impact to the position. So he's definitely one to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. So now that I've pimped out my story, it's time to do the same to Zach's from yesterday. Zach, you had a story air yesterday. It was a Q&A about Packers return specialists, kickoffs, punts. That's also something that we've talked about on this show before, but one of the things that came out yesterday was they are emphasizing the punt return unit because last year they were not very good in that department. This year they have quite a few guys back there, you know, in the kickoff return unit. Obviously there's some stuff there with Ty Montgomery, Jeff Janis, Trevor Davis has experience doing that as well. Those three guys are also in the discussion for the punt returner along with Micah Hyde. So, Zach, since it was your story, give us a little bit of background of, you know, what you were kind of saying there, and then give us your answer. Who do you think should be the primary returners when the Packers play September 11th against the Jacksonville Jaguars?
I'm going to stick with the golden boy, Jeff Janis. Next to him on run backs would ideally be Trevor Davis, since he was just so damn talented at doing it in college. He very elusive. And I think on punt returns, I'd stick with Micah Hyde, the guy who has been doing it for the last year or two. He hasn't been bad, but he hasn't been anything spectacular. It's enough for Micah Hyde to stick to punt returns to, you know, kind of preserve some other guys in the offense. Like, for example, Ty Montgomery. He's coming off an ankle injury. He has no business running back kicks now, especially after surgery. And this is something that has drawn a lot of popular opinion on my Twitter. A lot of people disagree with me. But I see Montgomery with more worth in the offense, you know, at the moment. That might not even be full force even with Jordy Nelson back, since we don't know really the word on his situation at the moment since he tweaked that other knee. But, you know, Montgomery, he's very versatile. He could be using the offense in a lot more ways than he can just running back a kick, which, in his defense, he is also another very talented guy that the Packers could put on special teams running back kicks. But if he didn't have that lingering ankle injury on his resume, I would totally be fine with putting him out there. But right now, given what happened in 2015, I would rather preserve him in the offense, keep Jeff Janis, Trevor Davis, and Micah Hyde as the main returners.
So there you have main returners from Zach. Jason, the return unit, special teams, one-third of the game. You know, last year we kind of saw a difference because the Packers had the worst kickoff return unit in all of football in 2014. And you kind of saw, really, starting in the first week of the season, the difference Ty Montgomery made. And then as the season went on, you saw the difference Jeff Janis made. Who are your guys that you want to be your returners for punts and kicks here?
Well, a couple interesting things about special teams. I was listening to Michael Cohen and Bob McGinn. They brought their podcast back and started talking about training camp and the position groups. And they spent some time on special teams. Brought up a couple really good points. You know, Rick Gosling of the Dallas, the exact name of the publication escapes me right now, but he does his special teams ranking. The Packers were dead last in 2014. They improved to about the middle of the pack last year. One of the reasons why is because, and I guess they kind of went back and looked over the last couple decades. You've had Brett Favre and you've had Aaron Rodgers, a quarterback, and those luxuries of scoring more points than the average team kind of allows you the luxury of spending maybe a little less time on special teams and more time on your actual defense and offensive unit. So the emphasis not being there, it's probably led a little bit to the fact that the Packers haven't been great. The big piece of that is the return game, because you've got field position at stake there. So last year, Jeff Janis seemed once a game to have kind of a little more of a flashy return than we did Montgomery. I think Montgomery had a nice return in training camp. He doesn't have the speed. So if Janis can't run the routes and get on the field as a receiver, he is, like you said earlier, Jacob, he is an ace on special teams. And I don't think that that's overstating how good he is, both in coverage and in the return game. So to me, in the kick return game, it's very obvious, as I don't want Randall Cobb back there. And I, you know, Randall Cobb has really more been brought in on punt return than kick return. So to me, it's Janis for sure on kick return. And then on punt return, this is an interesting one, because I know they've been, and I read an article that the special teams and Ron Zook, the coordinator, and the team want to place more emphasis on punt return specifically because they have such a low average. And Micah Hyde's been doing it. He's sure-handed, but he definitely doesn't have breakaway speed, although he has brought a couple back to the house. I happen to be watching one of them live in Minnesota against the Vikings back in 2013, when he had to try to best Cordero Patterson's 108-yard record-tying kickoff return touchdown on the opening kick, and he did, and the Packers ended up winning that game. So, I mean, he's sure-handed. He's a possibility there. I think rookies, it's tough because it's all about handling the ball. And there's a lot of decisions to be made on punt return in terms of fair catch return. Do you take it? You know, when do you return it? Boundary, non-boundary, you know, all those things have to be sharp. And rookies, you know, to learn all that is asking a lot. So, but I wouldn't mind seeing Trevor Davis's speed on that particular unit. Now, I don't know if they've worked him just more at kick return than punt return. I've heard that Randall Cobb is still taking some punt return reps in practice. So to me, if it's not broken, don't necessarily fix it. I'd love to see some more yardage, but in terms of not turning the ball over, I'd be okay with sticking with Hyde. So I guess my long-winded, you know, diatribe here circles back around to I would be okay with them sticking with who they had last year, because it wasn't awful. And I think that in another year, after having a full year of work at that spot, I think they can continue to make an improvement. And then you're talking about maybe being a top 15 special teams. If the offense can get back to their usual selves and the defense is on track, it looks like, to do well, then that means improved football all around. So that's my take on the whole special teams, and especially the returns. You either stick with the guys you got, or if Trevor Davis can step up, let him do so. I agree with Zach. Ty Montgomery, not this year. He's got to work on getting healthy. And if they're going to start using him at all, if he's well enough to play in the backfield and on some of those more creative formations, then I don't think special teams needs to be something that could potentially detract him in terms of health or any other issues that he might run into.
Definitely some interesting stuff here. The kickoff return, I'm with you guys. I've talked about it before. Ty Montgomery, I'm with you guys on that. He's in the offense. There's really not a huge need to stick him as a kick returner when there is a viable alternative, and that alternative is Jeff Janis. And Janis, like you guys said, did very well last year as a kickoff returner. He's got great straight-line speed. He's got good field vision. His problem offensively has been, you know, the little things. Well, returning kicks definitely has some little things in it, but it's not as complicated as setting up a defensive back by turning your hips one way, quickly turning the other way, and now you're open, and there you go for a big play. Janis can be a good kickoff returner, and I think we saw that last year. He had some really big returns. He became a kickoff returner against the Minnesota Vikings in Minnesota, had a big return in that game, had a big return Thanksgiving night against the Chicago Bears, had some other opportunities and made some big plays. As a returner, I think that there's your guy as a kickoff return. The punt return, I think, brings up an interesting comparison, because you guys are kind of talking about stick with what you have, because you know he's not going to fumble, you know he'll catch the ball, those kinds of things. It reminds me of when the Packers had Randall Cobb still as their primary returner, and there was a guy named Jeremy Ross who was making some decent plays as a returner, and he would came close to breaking a couple. And the Packers made a switch before the divisional round game against the San Francisco 49ers. Now, that game is known widely as the Colin Kaepernick game, but something that kind of gets lost in the shuffle there is the Packers were winning 14-7, and Jeremy Ross signaled for a fair catch, and he fumbled the football, and the 49ers recovered it. And instead of having the ball with a chance to go up 21-7 and kind of taking away at least a little bit some of the running game that the 49ers wanted to run that night, instead of having that opportunity, now it was 14-14 very quickly. And, you know, from there, the Packers obviously just kind of fell apart defensively. But, Jeremy Ross, in essence, was the turning point of that football game. And the Packers should have stuck with, that night at least, what they knew all year long. They took a risk in putting the new guy back there for hopefully what they were hoping for, some explosive returns and preserving Randall Cobb for the offense. Now, it's a little different because they don't have a week between things. Now's the time where I think you can see, can you find someone more? Can you find somebody that can still catch the ball, make his cuts, be sure-handed, and hold on to the football while also getting some more explosive nature in the return game? And here's my thing. If the Packers are going to keep six wide receivers, two of them at least have to be able to make some impact on special teams, whether that's as a returner or that's as a gunner like Jeff Janis, or whether that's as some other things that they can do within special teams. But my guy for this, I said it before, you pick Trevor Davis in the fifth round, you're probably not going to cut him. And a guy with his speed is probably not making it to the practice squad, because guys that can run like that just don't make it to the practice squad. Somebody who's not a good football team, has bad wide receivers, can afford to just kind of say, here, kid, you run really fast. You're our third receiver now. And that's something that the Packers would probably strongly have to consider when it comes to final roster cutdowns. With that being said, Trevor Davis, more likely than not, is your fifth or sixth receiver on the roster. That means he has to contribute on special teams in some way. I think that he could do that in a kickoff return game, but I've already kind of mentioned my point for Jeff Janis there. But I think he can give the Packers something in the punt return game. As long as he can find the ball, catch it, I think he can make some plays in the open field. I think that's the guy that I am really rooting for to win that job. Obviously, there's a lot of time between now and when the Packers actually have to make that decision. But I am hoping for Trevor Davis because he's quicker, he's faster, he's more explosive, and that's nothing against Micah Hyde. He's been a good punt returner, at least he was in 2014. Last season, not so much, but, you know, and he's done some nice things. But at some point, I always felt like Hyde as a punt returner had an expiration date. And I think that date may have passed. I think it's time for Trevor Davis. Hopefully he can win that job. Packers draft class, really off to a good start if you guys have paid attention to practice. The big one, really, is the defensive line. When it comes to the defensive line this year, the Packers have Mike Daniels, who's very good. I've talked about him several times, and he's finally starting to get some publicity because he's a very good player, which is good. LaTroy Guyon is the other one. After that, not a ton of experience, especially with Mike Pennell missing the first four games due to a suspension. That means Kenny Clark and Dean Lowry have to play big early. Kenny Clark is off to a very good start. He's undefeated in his pass rushing one-on-ones, which is, I've told you guys before, one of my favorite things to watch in training camp is how players do in one-on-ones. And Kenny Clark is undefeated, and it's not like he's facing some back-end roster fodder. He's beaten J.C. Treader. That's a good player. The Packers have said they view him as a starter. Clark is 4-0 to begin. The other one defensively is Blake Martinez. They have a lot on his plate early. They said mentally they don't think he'll be overwhelmed. Remains to be seen if he can do some things physically, but he's also been in nice position on a lot of plays. A lot of good stuff coming from the Packers' first and fourth-round pick, well, one of their fourth-round picks, I should say. But I want to start with Kenny Clark because it was a little bit of a low pick because Vernon Butler was on the board. Jason's guy, Miles Jack, was on the board. You know, the Packers had some options there, and they took a guy that at least wasn't that highly touted by your Mel Kuypers, your Todd McShays, guys like that. So it was a little bit of a surprise that they took Kenny Clark, but Zach, we can start with you here. What kind of impact do you think Kenny Clark can make, and what kind of impact does he have to make? Because those can be two different things.
Well, luckily for the Packers, Kenny Clark's a guy who can come in right in week one, and he could start. He has a similar body type to his predecessor, B.J. Raji, minus 20 or so pounds. But he's going to be a big part of that front seven and applying pressure this season. And, you know, they don't necessarily need him to be effective right off the bat, but if he can be, that's definitely going to be a plus. And like you said, he has been just having a tremendous camp, winning all of his one-on-ones. I believe he's 8-0, correct me if I'm wrong. He is just really impressing. And if they can come in and get that guy at the heart of their front seven, right up the gut, just putting pressure, then that's, you know, going to pay huge dividends. And like you said, there were some guys on the board when the Packers took Clark, and I was surprised by the pick because this was a guy I didn't even really do much homework on. I honestly didn't even know the guy's name, and it kind of reminded me of back in 2007 when the Packers picked Johnny Jolly, and there was just all sorts of these videos just sprouting over the internet of fans flipping out, like, oh, like, who's this guy? I'm still looking for a video of that for Kenny Clark, and when he comes into the starting lineup and he proves to be effective, then if those fans do exist, they're probably going to be eating their words.
Absolutely agree. I think that, you know, you can see some confusion the night of the draft, but I like what you said. You know, he's young and it may take him a little bit of time, but I think that he's a smart kid. He can come in, he can contribute right away. Dean Lowry, kind of the same thing, smart, big, and really that body type, and I've hammered on this since they drafted him, that the Packers haven't had for a five tech. So those are two young guys that the Packers can try to rely on early on, and they're going to have to. But, you know, they've talked about it. They need those guys to play well early because, you know, I know the Packers only play two defensive linemen 70% of the time, but with those young defensive linemen, the Packers haven't stopped the run that well the last couple years. Teams are going to run at them early and often. The Packers have to be up to the task. Otherwise, unleashing this pass rush, and believe me, there's plenty of guys there. Clay Matthews, Julius Peppers, Nick Perry, who we'll get to in a minute. Some of those guys just aren't going to matter that much from a pass rushing standpoint because it's going to be 3rd and 2, 3rd and 3, instead of 3rd and 8, 3rd and 9 if the Packers can't stop the run. And that's been a thing the last few years. The Packers haven't been able to stop the run. And when their defense really has been at their best, last year in the playoffs, for example, they made the opposing offense one-dimensional. I've talked about it before. LaTroy Guyon and B.J. Raji played very well in the playoffs last season, and that allowed the Packers defense to unleash their pass rush, and that's what they want to do. But in order to unleash your pass rush, you have to stop the run. Everybody's talking about Denver's pass rush from last season. One thing that goes unnoticed, Malik Jackson, Derek Wolfe, Brandon Marshall, Danny Trevathan, guys like that, were very good at stopping the run, and they put the opposing offenses in some unfavorable down and distances. And that sounds old school and cliche, but it's still true. I know a lot of teams want to throw the football, but if they can run, they will. And especially that Week 2 game against the Minnesota Vikings, that Adrian Peterson guy is still a thing in Minnesota. The Vikings are still going to hand him the ball a lot. The Packers have to be able to stop them. There's other guys. If the Packers get to the playoffs this year and play the Carolina Panthers, same thing. Seattle Seahawks, same thing. There's a lot of things that the Packers need to do defensively this year, and it really starts with their front seven, but that starts with stopping the run. Jason, what are your feelings here on the defensive line? Do you have a high level of concern, or is it relatively low?
I probably fall somewhere in the middle on it because we kind of talked about it last week too. The Mike Pennell suspension, him being out 4 weeks, so there's one vet that's gone. They've already lost Raji. So now you're going to rely on Kenny Clark to come in and contribute right away. But if there's one pick in the draft class that should be doing that, it's your first rounder. So that's a wash because I think Kenny Clark has shown in practice already that he's going to be able to play some meaningful snaps early on, and I think he'll be at least somewhat effective. So no reason to think that that's going to be a total disaster. But then you've got Dayton, and I want to see him in his new position and how effective he can be. Do they maybe try to supplement Julius Peppers in there a little bit early on? Does he play a few more snaps than he might have otherwise or that he will later in the season because of that shortfall? Because Dean Lowry right now, we don't know what we have in him. We still need to see more game action and how he comes up. And then you've got Christian Ringo and a couple of undrafted guys that are going to duke it out. And, of course, obviously, you know, Mike Daniels back there, it makes everybody rest a little bit easier at night. So, I mean, if it was on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is I'm completely comfortable and 1 is I'm not comfortable at all, I think I'm probably at about a 6 right now just because of the unknown factor and the use that the defensive line has. And being a young player on the defensive line is probably a tough. There's a lot of big jumps to be made from a rookie into a veteran as far as being up front, especially in a complex defense like Dom Capers, especially in a 3-4, which is a little bit different than a 4-3 where the lineman's responsibilities and what they have to do requires a little bit more thought prep. It's not just, you know, piss and vinegar to get to the quarterback. So that's about where I'm at with it. But I'm encouraged so far, like you said, Clark, when the one-on-ones, you know, I pay attention to stuff like that. And that's, you know, like you said, he's not just going up against nobody. You know, these are starters on the Packers offensive line, some of which have been to Pro Bowl. So I'm encouraged. I'd say 6, and the needle to me is definitely pointing up.
Good to hear, especially early in camp. Optimism, I suspect, is always going to reign supreme, but that is always something to keep an eye on, whether or not the Packers will have enough depth and girth and ability on the defensive line to slow down some of these rushing attacks that they are likely to see early on. Perhaps the biggest news that I think a lot of people are just kind of sweeping under the rug, Jason, you and I have kind of discussed this a little bit, but we didn't really know how to go about it. And that was the talk of reducing Julius Peppers' role for what will be his final season in Green Bay, barring something completely unforeseen. And it appears the answer to our question is a bigger role for who I affectionately refer to as NFP, Nick Perry. You can fill in the blank again. Nick Perry has a bigger role this year. This is the first year he's actually been able to take part in the offseason program, but it appears that Clay Matthews is a starting outside linebacker, and Nick Perry is the other one. Julius Peppers is lining up with twos, and it looks like he's becoming, at least early in camp, a pass-rushing specialist as opposed to your every-down outside linebacker. I'm kind of excited about this, though, because I know last year when Julius Peppers was fresh, he was dominant. He still has some ability to him. I just don't think he has the ability to be an every-down player anymore, and that's natural. The guy's an older player, played a long time in the NFL. Players just lose a step at some point. But when he's been fresh, he has spurts when he's very, very good. He'll rush from the inside. He'll rush from the outside. But it sounds like they're bringing him in on passing downs. But what, Zach, we can start with you here. What do you think about these big plans with Nick Perry? And do you think this lasts? Because, you know, the Packers have also been prone in the past to give the nod, so to speak, to a veteran player over a younger guy who's been ascending. An example for last year would include Mike Neal over, say, Jayrone Elliott. But do you think these last, and what do you make of Nick Perry's expanded role in what could possibly be his final season in Green Bay as well?
I think it lasts for really a majority of the duration of the season. Julius Peppers, he's not getting any younger. He's 36. He'll be 37 by the end of the season. And, you know, putting on somewhat of a pitch count, that's really kind of a necessity at this point, given his age. And Nick Perry, we know what he could do. He came in his rookie year in 2012. He started making some noise, and he's kind of been hampered by injuries every so often. But if he could stay healthy, he's really going to come really into his own role at outside linebacker. He's very, very good pass rusher off the edge. He could drop into coverage. I like Julius Peppers dropping into coverage. He brings the veteran savvy to that linebacking corps. You can make an argument Clay Matthews does as well, but Julius Peppers is on a whole other level. And the thing is, too, when you put Julius Peppers on that pitch count, you also have Jayrone Elliott. As you mentioned, you have Jayrone Elliott back there, who he also got off to a fast start in 2015 until he suffered that I believe it was a quad or hamstring injury, and he kind of slowed down until he was knocked out for the next 3 weeks by week 15. So, you know, there's good depth behind Julius Peppers. It gives the Packers a lot more leverage to work with those outside linebackers. Now you got Clay Matthews on the opposite end. Dayton Jones coming into his elephant role as a hybrid defensive end, outside linebacker. Kind of, I really like the idea. And, you know, like I said, it's really a necessity at this point with Julius Peppers, given his age. And, you know, we don't know if this is his final year. It's really up in the air right now with Peppers, but I like the whole concept.
I like the whole concept as well. I've talked about it before. Dayton Jones' best games as a player have come when he's played on the edge. I'm excited for his role as well. Like the third-round pick of Kyler Fackrell, we will see if he can make an impact his first year. And I've liked Jayrone Elliott for the last year and a half. It just seems like when he's on the field, he just makes plays. And on defense, especially for a team looking to put the quarterback on the ground, Jayrone Elliott's done a good job of that. He obviously maybe the happiest I've ever been after a regular season game was after the play he made against the Seattle Seahawks that clinched that win in week 2 last season. So a lot of good stuff on the outside linebackers, really, and it starts with Nick Perry. And, you know, the big bugaboo or, you know, whatever you want to, the monk elephant in the room for Nick Perry has been his health. It always seems he builds momentum, he gets hurt. He comes back, he builds momentum, he gets hurt. He comes back, he builds momentum, he gets hurt. You see where I'm going with all this kind of stuff. That's the other thing about the new role. You can keep Julius Peppers on a pitch count if all these guys are healthy. But if there's some injuries or something that takes guys out, now you're talking about Julius Peppers becoming an every-down player once again. So, Jason, before we move on, what are your thoughts here on the reduced role for Julius Peppers?
Well, I think it's definitely time for that to happen because of his age, and they're going to scale it back. He's not going to be effective as a full-time guy anymore, so that's fine. I am encouraged by what I hear about Nick Perry, how he's doing well in practice. I mean, the fact that he's healthy enough to participate, because he's definitely not been that in the past. I think it was after the 2014 season, maybe heading into last year's training camp, if I'm not mistaken, when Winston Moss was interviewed and he talked about Nick Perry and basically called Nick Perry out and just said he has done absolutely zero to solidify himself at that point. I think he was dealing with an injury. He wasn't able to participate in the off-season program. And so it was basically one of those deals where it's like, I don't even know what we have in Nick, position coach, because he's not healthy enough to be on the field. Well, another contract year for Nick Perry. You know, he was in one last year. In a way, the Packers decided not to pick up that option, so he played last year knowing that he may not be back this year. They re-signed him to a one-year deal. I don't know if he got offers from other teams or not, but he's back in Green Bay, so he has another prove-it year. But I also listened to him speak a little bit on one of the local radio shows in Green Bay or in Wisconsin, and he sounds very motivated. It sounds like he's got the right mentality, and we know he makes plays in bunches. So I think it's fine. I think if Peppers can see his role reduced and if Nick Perry can stay healthy, he's never given the Packers 16 games, so we can't assume he's going to do that this year. Then I think it's a wash. I think they'll be completely fine. They might even be in a little bit better shape because Peppers makes a few impact plays. I mean, he was really good in 2014. Last year he made a few, you know, with his savvy, and I think he'll do that again this year. But I think, Jacob, I'll probably lean more towards what your line of thinking is, where I think this is it for Peppers. It's probably his last year, at least in Green Bay. If he wants to play somewhere else, that's fine. You know, so I don't know if his playing days are going to be over. But the reduced role, it's got to happen, because he was already kind of, you know, getting tabbed as a guy who maybe didn't play hard every snap, and they wanted to keep him fresh for the last part of the game. So rather than put a guy out there who's going to go half speed, why not put Nick Perry out there who can go full tilt, and then put Julius Peppers out there who can also go full tilt at the end of a game when his savvy and his knowledge of the game and his years of experience will come in really handy. So overall, I'm encouraged by it so far. But again, it's only the first week of camp, and like you said, there's a lot more that we need to see before we come to any major conclusions.
Absolutely agree. That's also something I've been trying to keep track of, pass rushing reps, stuff like that with the outside linebackers, because I think there's a lot of talent there. And I really do think this might be the best rotation group that the Packers have had since Tom Capers took over in 2008, 2009. I think it was 2009. It's been a long time is what that means, but it's the best group he's ever had. So that is a good thing. We'll see how much it translates to on the field. One last topic before we let Zach go. I know you've got some plans for the day, and hopefully we didn't keep you too long, but defensive back, we've talked about the talent in the defensive backfield, Morgan Burnett, Ha-ha Clinton Dix, Sam Shields, Demarius Randall, Quentin Rollins. Something they did today that was interesting was Ladarius Gunter lined up as the outside corner opposite of Sam Shields. They've been moving Quentin Rollins and Demarius Randall around outside and inside. When both of them have been on the field in nickel, Rollins has taken more reps on the outside and Randall has been in the slot. And I believe since the last time we did a show, Matt Miller tweeted that he was excited for Demarius Randall as the, quote, new Tyrann Mathieu in the Packers defense. That's a hell of an endorsement for a guy who really played well last year. Demarius Randall was a very good player as pretty much strictly an outside corner. This year they're talking about moving him around a little bit. Maybe Quentin Rollins plays the slot as well. But Ladarius Gunter is also, according to Joe Witt, right there with those two guys. That's incredible to me to think about, because that's an undrafted free agent who really was brought in as thought to be more of a camp body than anything else. And now you're talking about a guy that could maybe start on the outside across from Sam Shields. And, you know, those are first and second round picks. That speaks to the depth. I don't think it's a detriment to Randall or Rollins. I don't think it's a slight against those guys by any stretch. I think it really is a compliment to how well Ladarius Gunter has played since he's come into camp last year. And he's continued that throughout the season. He had a nice stretch at the end last year where he got on the field, made some plays against the Washington Redskins. He's an outside corner and can allow the Packers in the dime. This is really intriguing to me. The idea of playing in the dime with, from left to right, Sam Shields, Quentin Rollins, Demarius Randall, and Ladarius Gunter. And with the other stuff the Packers are talking about doing, Morgan Burnett has played some linebacker this year as their hybrid type. So that is something else that they've looked at, is maybe their coverage linebacker is Morgan Burnett, which means you have Ha-Ha Clinton Dix and Micah Hyde as your deep safeties, or maybe Chris Banjo, or if somebody else emerges. But Packers have a lot of options in the defensive backfield. Zach, how excited are you about this group, and how do you feel about the reported roles, specifically for Randall, Rollins, and Gunter coming into this season?
Well, you can ask Aaron Nagler himself. He knows I wasn't too sold on the Ladarius Gunter by the start of camp, based off of his whole career thus far. It hasn't been anything special to give me any reason to believe he could be anything special, but really he has just come into his own role the last couple days in camp, and like you said, like all the reports have said, he's really impressing. And when he's splitting time at corner opposite Sam Shields, I think that's something definitely to keep an eye on. I'm still trying to swallow my pride and admit that Aaron was right, which he is on a lot of things. I'll give him credit for that. If Ladarius Gunter can prove to be something special, then that's I will gladly eat crow. That's just good for the Packers secondary, good for the fans, good for, you know, the whole defense as a whole. And as far as Randall and Rollins in the slot go, they really just swap in spots. I like Rollins on the outside. He's the more physical of the two corners, the two second-year corners. And, you know, now with Casey Hayward, now he's not in the mix anymore. You get the bigger body of those two, put him on the outside receiver and Randall in the slot. I really like the whole mix-up. And, you know, back to the Darius Gunter, if he does find a way to prove effective in this Packers secondary, he'd be joining, as an undrafted, he'd be joining a secondary that is led by an undrafted free agent from 2010 and Sam Shields. So that'd be good for him. And as far as Morgan Burnett playing a hybrid, that would also probably be pretty detrimental to the Packers' defense, because we know hybrids are evolving in the NFL today. The whole defensive scheme, the landscape is all evolving. Tyron Matthew, he's a hybrid. You have guys like Philip Cannon, I believe. He's a hybrid. You know, these guys are peering out of the woodwork left and right. So if Morgan Burnett can prove to add that different level to his game, heighten his playing level, that would also be something definitely to keep an eye on. I like that they're experimenting with new things. So Dom Capers really twisting the screws in his head, trying to come up with some new defensive schemes.
Absolutely agree. It's an intriguing, it really is. It feels like for the first time in quite some time that the Packers have enough chess pieces for Capers to move around and play with. Obviously, it's up to him to find the right mix. This, I don't know, that's hard to say, because 2014, I thought the Packers had a really good corner group, Shields, Tremont Williams, Devon House, and Casey Hayward, and I'm starting to think that this one could potentially be better. Obviously, the gold standard for corner group is 2010, where you had Tremont Williams playing lights out, you had Sam Shields playing very well as a rookie, and you had the greatest corner of all time in Charles Woodson doing things all over the place for that Packers defense. That is the gold standard, but this group may be just as good, and that all remains to be seen. But there's a lot of good things coming out of the Packers defensive backfield this year. Zach, I want to thank you for coming on today's show. Obviously, I think, assuming our captain, Jason Perrone, says it's okay, you are welcome back anytime. We appreciate having you. Give us a little shout here just for kicks, just like the beginning of the show here. How do we find your stuff? Who are you? Your Twitter handle, all that kind of stuff. Promote yourself. This is your floor.
Awesome. My Twitter handle is Zach, Z-A-C-H-A, Jacobson, J-A-C-O-B-S-O-N. You can find me on Twitter with that handle. You can find me at Cheesehead TV. Again, I want to thank you guys for welcoming me on the show, and it was really a pleasure. Always nice talking Packers football, you know, at the end of July, coming on to August. First preseason game right around the corner. Family night tomorrow.
Family night tomorrow, Hall of Fame game next week. And one thing I think I learned today more than anything is anybody that comes on False of the Pack with the name Jacob in their name cannot give bad analysis. So, Zach, thank you. Thank you very much for coming. We hope to hear from you very soon.
Awesome. Thank you guys again. Take it easy.
Thanks, Zach.
That is Zach Jacobson of Cheesehead TV. Want to thank him once again for coming onto the show. That was a solid hour of really good content. Appreciate him. Like you said, you can find him on Cheesehead TV. You can follow him on Twitter. He's got some good stuff. It comes out relatively often. I know for a fact I read it every single day whenever it comes out. So he's got some good stuff coming. Jason, last week, we lied. Dun, dun, dun. We said that we would take questions from our listeners, and we did not. So this week, we did have a couple questions come in. I do want to answer them. The first one I want to start with comes from a guy. His Twitter name is Italian Packers at IPFNet. His question is very simple. Is it Super Bowl or bust this year? And I think it's that way every year is my answer. You have Aaron Rodgers. You have a Hall of Fame quarterback. The city is referred to as Titletown USA, and they are not referring to division titles. A story from Peter King came out on Monday Morning Quarterback about the urgency the Packers have to win another title. They know that the clock is ticking a little bit on Aaron Rodgers' career. They want to get back to a Super Bowl. They want to get back and win. You look at this roster from top to bottom. I mean, obviously there's questions. Every team has questions. Even the Denver Broncos last season won the Super Bowl. They had questions. The Panthers went 15-1 last year. They were the best team in football all year, and they had questions. The Packers obviously have those as well. But if you look at this roster from a talent standpoint, from top to bottom, it may be at or very near the top of most talented roster in all of the league. That's a team that has to cash in and win a Super Bowl, whether it's this year or the next couple of years. But at some point, these close playoff losses, kind of fluky games or complete meltdowns, if you're talking about the NFC Championship game against the Seattle Seahawks, have to stop. There's getting it done, and there's not getting it done. And the Packers haven't got it done since 2010. So, yes, it is Super Bowl or bust. Jason, do you agree?
I do. You pretty much nailed it right there. You hit on all the major points I would have as well. It comes down to if you have the most important position on the field covered, which is quarterback, and not only do the Packers have it covered, but they have it covered in possibly the best way of any other team in the league, you have to win games. You have to emerge successful and with a lot of accolades to what you did and a lot of achievement that follows. So, yep, absolutely. Aaron Rodgers is still quarterback, and he's capable. It's a Super Bowl or bust year for sure.
And then our other question that came in, we had a couple that come in that I suspect were incredibly sarcastic from this gentleman, but this one at least appeared to be serious, so I will answer it. And as we've noted, guys, you can send your questions at Packer Pulse. I'm going to try and do a better job of incorporating those into the show. So here's two questions that we had. This one from John Rehor. He's at J-R-E-H-O-R. His question, Mike McCarthy's hot seat status. Obviously, there's been discussion about this year being maybe a big year for Mike McCarthy. So, Jason, I want to start with you because I have a very strong opinion on this. Is it white hot? Is it ice bowl cold? Is it somewhere in the middle? What do you think?
Man, this is a great question and a great topic. I think, you know, the mass majority will say, they'll point to the spoiled Packer fans' whole mantra when you start talking about the possibility of Mike McCarthy even being remotely in danger of losing his job or being discussed about underachieving or not doing well. But I don't think there's anything wrong with taking a step back and saying, is there room for improvement? You know, Jacob, you mentioned in the last answer about these playoff losses, and I know that the coaches aren't on the field, and this coaching staff I have a lot of faith in to prepare this team, get them ready. They've obviously proven, Mike McCarthy has proven over a decade that he can definitely put a successful team on the field. Granted, he's been blessed with two straight Hall of Fame caliber quarterbacks, one of which is going to be in the Hall, and another one that should be following shortly after his playing days are over. But the playoff losses, you know, you do have to kind of look at the leadership and say, what is missing here? Why is this happening? You know, these teams are coming so close, but they can't close the deal. They can't get it done. They fall apart in crunch time. The meltdown in Seattle, the call it a meltdown in Arizona because it was a missed assignment by Demaryius Randle that led to that long play to set up the touchdown. The 5 out of 7 playoff losses on the last play of the game. You know, think about Arizona in 2009, you know, which was kind of an atrocity because of blatantly missed calls against the Packers on the defensive side. But I think it's in the middle. I think it should be somewhere in the middle. You've got to keep these coaches honest. You want somebody coming into their job thing knowing that they're completely safe and that they can, you know, quote unquote, take days off. I mean, we talk about players who take plays off. Do you want a coach coming in with absolutely no fear at all that they might lose their job? The other thing we have to keep in mind, too, is that whether we want to hear it or not, football fans, there is a business side to this. And we want to believe that the front offices and the ownership of all these teams and the brain trust of the Packers are doing everything they can to win because we want to win another trophy, we being the fans. Yeah, they want to be successful, but if you read into it, sometimes getting to the playoffs and going on these deep playoff runs isn't as profitable as you think. And so you'd be surprised how some teams don't necessarily have as much of a vested interest in this as fans do. So while it might, you know, we can sit here and talk about, okay, yeah, Mike McCarthy, the playoff losses, all those things, which I brought up and I think are important from a fan's perspective, from a business perspective, you know, I would probably say his seat is much hotter amongst the fans and maybe with the media than it is with his actual bosses. But no, I'm not going to say it's zero because 10 years in, you've got two Hall of Fame quarterbacks you've had on your watch. You got one Super Bowl victory, which is more than some other very successful coaches have had. I completely understand that, but at this point in the game and with Aaron Rodgers and the way that this team is structured and the potential that they have, to not get another one to me is going to sting, and it's definitely going to resonate with Packers fans. So he's got to be feeling at least a little bit of heat, I think.
Mike McCarthy is the best coach in Packers history, not named Vince Lombardi. Yes, I did just say there's getting it done and there's not getting it done. I understand that. But it's not Mike McCarthy's fault that Brandon Bostic didn't do his job. It's not Mike McCarthy's fault that Demarius Randle didn't do his job last year in the playoffs. There's a lot of other things that have happened that I don't think fans point to as positives in the Mike McCarthy tenure. You talk, you know, everybody points to the Super Bowl season, which obvious, they won a Super Bowl. And I go, they had 15 guys on injured reserve and they won the Super Bowl. That is a fantastic coaching job, first of all, because 15 guys on injured reserve is an easy excuse to give for reasons why they didn't win. That would be an easy excuse. McCarthy never bought into that. He kept the ship straight. The Packers had their struggles. They had some fortune go their way. They got into the playoffs, and then they really, in essence, dominated in the playoffs. I know some of the final scores were close. That Bears game wasn't as close as the final score says it was. That Eagles game, the Packers played very well. I know they won it on an interception at the end of the game. The Packers were clearly the better team throughout that game. They steamrolled Atlanta in the playoffs. And if Charles Woodson and Sam Shields don't get hurt, the Packers win that Super Bowl 45-3. Steelers didn't do anything against the Packers starting defense. Only after Woodson and Shields exited did the Steelers do anything. But there's been other years. The next year, I know they were one and done in the playoffs. They go 15-1 with the biggest bullseye on their back because they're the defending Super Bowl champions. They almost go undefeated. That's a great coaching job. 2 years later, the starting quarterback breaks his collarbone and misses 8 games. They still made the playoffs and almost beat a 49ers team that was clearly better than they were. Clearly better. That 49ers team should have won that game by 2 touchdowns. They didn't. Some of that has to do with the players on the field. I fully understand that. But Mike McCarthy had a lot to do with that as well. Last year, Packers offense, Mike McCarthy admittedly overreacted to losing the NFC Championship game. And he made some mistakes in that game as well. I'm not going to pretend he was perfect in that game. He made some mistakes as well. But he goes to one of his friends and says, hey, the move I made isn't working out. Give me the play sheet back. That's hard to do. Now, does McCarthy have some faults? Absolutely. I'm not going to argue that he doesn't. He's loyal to a fault sometimes. He believes in his guys, which really I don't think is a horrible thing. Sometimes it turns out poorly. But if the worst thing you could say about somebody is he believes in his guys too much, would you rather have a coach that didn't believe in his guys enough? And the one question I always ask anyone that ever wants to bring up, Mike McCarthy should be fired. That's fine if you want to think that. If not him, who? Look at some of the guys who got hired last year. Hugh Jackson, real excited about that. Adam Gase, maybe. There's a hot coordinator every single year, and a lot of them really do seem to fail. John Gruden's not coming out of the booth, neither is Bill Cowher. I'm not sure how good of a coach John Gruden was anyways. Mike McCarthy's seat, I'll give you a little bit of heat. Maybe a little, just because, like I said earlier, there's getting it done and there's not getting it done. But I wake up every morning as a fan, and I'm proud to know that guy is my team's head coach. I think Packers fans should feel the same way. They made the playoffs 7 consecutive years. Not a lot of teams have done that. I don't recall a lot of people calling for Bill Belichick's head when they went 10 years between Super Bowl titles. They lost 2 Super Bowls and a couple AFC championship games in that time frame as well. I don't recall a lot of people calling for his head. Now, I know he had 3 in the bank already, so it is a little different. That's still 10 years, and it's still very similar. He has Tom Brady. He's a Hall of Fame quarterback. They went 10 years between winning titles. Packers have gone 6. And everybody wants to talk about how this could be such a massive disappointment if they only get 2 titles with 2 Hall of Fame quarterbacks back-to-back. Aaron Rodgers still has a long time left to play. Let's let this play out. At the end of the whole thing, if it's only 2 titles, then, yeah, you can call it disappointing. But for now, there's plenty of time between that. Mike McCarthy is one of the best coaches in all of football. The Packers should be very thankful that they have him. One more thing before we take off. Next week, Hall of Fame game. 1 week from today, Brett Favre gets enshrined into the Packers, not the Packers, excuse me, the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Deanna Favre will be his presenter. I'm looking forward to all that stuff. Very excited for that weekend. I will be down there and in attendance. Last week, we discussed two of our favorite Favre memories. I told you him running around the field with his helmet and then spitting up blood and then throwing a touchdown on the next play. We got to give two more today because it's only fitting that we give four favorite Favre memories for number four. Am I wrong? So, Jason,
last week you had the Raiders game, and I believe the other one was the press conference after beating the Raiders where he was just so physically spent he couldn't get through the press conference. So those were your two. What are the two others?
Man, yeah, how funny that they both tied back to the Raiders, who the Packers rarely play because they're AFC and NFC teams. I mean, I think back to maybe it's not necessarily specific moments, but I think back to games because I dealt with that mediocrity phase in the 80s where the Packers weren't very good. And so I think about – yeah, the touchdown pass to Kittrick Taylor was his first as a Packer, and everybody got excited. But when did I really start to believe that Favre was going to make the Packers special? And I think it was in the playoff game after the 1995 season where they beat the Falcons to then advance, and I think that was what catapulted them into the game at San Francisco where they would go and beat the 49ers to play the Dallas Cowboys. So I look at those two games, Atlanta and San Fran, and that was where I saw the Packers do something that they hadn't done before. They hadn't gotten past the Cowboys the past couple seasons. I think they drew Dallas the first round after both of those previous years, so they didn't even win a playoff game. Then I see them take out the Falcons at Lambeau Field and then go on the road and just knock the snot out of the San Francisco 49ers, who everyone, maybe some may forget, were the defending champions at that time. And that's where I knew that they had a chance to do something special, possibly that season, and they were in the lead against Dallas the following week in the NFC Championship game in Dallas in the fourth quarter, and just got outplayed and didn't make the Super Bowl that year. But I think everyone knew 96 was going to be a special year and they were going to get it done, and surely they did. So I guess I'll point to those two games because it's not like I can remember specific things that happened. I mean, Favre definitely in that Niners game to me was very well composed. I mean, talking about a guy who felt like he belonged, he looked like he belonged out there. You got Steve Young, Jerry Rice, all these guys that have won multiple championships. The storied history of the Niners at that point, they were still kind of one of those teams to beat always every year. It had decade worth of success. And you got Brett Favre out there playing like a kid. Looks like he totally belongs. And that's when I knew, okay, this guy is one of the best quarterbacks in the game. The Packers have a quarterback. They have the guy. They have the guy that can get it done. So I'm going to be glued to the TV next week. And this is a big moment for me to watch Brett Favre going because I've thought about, even before he left Green Bay, what's it going to be like to actually watch this guy go into the Pro Football Hall of Fame? Because this was a guy that, you know, I've seen Packers go into the Hall of Fame and in the past, but this is a guy who I've watched from start to finish of his career. I'm finally of the age now where I can say these guys are going to the Hall of Fame, and I watched their entire careers play out. And this was my guy, and he led my football team to a championship, which at that point in my life, and I think I was 20 when they won the Super Bowl, I had never had any team that I followed win a major championship. That was the first of any kind. So this is going to be a huge moment. I could not be more envious that you're going to be in the crowd. I'm looking forward to some awesome pictures, stories, and everything else that goes with it in that experience, man. Soak it up for everything that it is because four is a legend and it's going to get cemented next week.
I'm absolutely looking forward to it as well, but I think you knew that already. My two memories, one, you can't talk about Brett Favre without talking about that night in December against Oakland. You know, one specific play that sticks out to me on that is he's rolling left, and he throws one to Wesley Walls, of all people. Wesley Walls makes a play in the back of the end zone. It's a perfect throw, good coverage, perfect throw, maybe the best of Farr's career. He was lights out that night. And it's amazing to me to think about, you know, he just had a parent pass away a couple days prior, and to come out and play in front of everyone. That was Monday Night Football. And I know some of our younger viewers probably think Sunday Night Football is the big deal now because it has been for the last couple of years. Monday Night Football was the thing back then. Everybody stopped what they were doing to watch Monday Night Football. Brett Favre played that game in front of everybody. Raiders fans, the black hole, the crazy people in Oakland are saying, giving condolences to Deanna Favre, Brett Favre, all those guys. It's amazing to me to think about how well he played that night, considering the circumstances. And the other one, really the first record I ever saw broken was Favre's 421st touchdown pass. I remember it was against the Minnesota Vikings. It was Greg Jennings on a slant on a 3rd and 7 over the middle of the field. Jennings walks in the end zone. Favre freaks out. Anybody that has the old put her in the old vice sound clip, that's what that's from, that whole thing. Watching him break that record, I didn't have to, but helped cement himself as one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time. It's incredible to think about. You know, we're Packers fans are incredibly spoiled for the last 30 years or so having really, really good quarterback play in that time frame. So those are my memories on Brett Favre. I will let you guys know how next week goes. Like I said, I'll be in Canton. I think we're leaving on Saturday morning, so I'll let you guys know how that all goes. But that'll do it for today's show. Be sure to check out PackersTalk.com for all your latest Packers news and podcasts. We're with Cheesehead TV now. I want to thank our sponsor, new sponsor, Ticket King. So get all your tickets for Packers games through Ticket King. It's not that far from the stadium. It's a short little walk, so it's a nice little place to buy, reserve your tickets, pick them up, go in, cheer on the Pack. I want to thank Zach Jacobson for coming on. Once again, great analysis from him. We'll definitely try to have him back as well. You can follow the show on Twitter. Send us your questions at Packer Pulse. You can send stuff to us personally. You can send it to me. I'm at Jacob Westendorf. You can send it to Jason at Jason Perrone. 1 week, Packers football, Sunday night next week against the Indianapolis Colts in the Hall of Fame game. Brett Favre gets enshrined into the Hall of Fame on Saturday. Listen to the speech. Soak it all in, guys. It's a great experience. I've always liked watching the Pro Football Hall of Fame speeches, but this one's a little different, a little more special this year because it's Brett Favre. So thanks for listening, guys. We'll talk to you guys hopefully next week, schedule permitting for me, obviously, since I'll be a little busy, I think. But schedule permitting, we'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks for listening to Pulse of the Pack.
Of the Pack Podcast.
Do you want to experience the thrill of a Packers game at Lambeau Field? If so, be sure to get your game ticket from the longtime trusted source in Wisconsin, Ticket King. Visit their locations in Milwaukee and Green Bay, or just go to their website at ticketking.com. Again, that's theticketking.com.